Welcome to Repro's Fight Back, a podcast on all things repro. I'm your host, Jenny Wetter, and each episode I will be taking you to the front lines of the escalating fight over our sexual and reproductive health and rights at home and abroad. Each episode I will be speaking with leaders who are fighting to protect our reproductive health and rights to ensure that no one's reproductive health depends on where they live. It's time for Repro's to fight back. Welcome to Repro's Fight Back. I'm your host, Jenny Wetter. Today we're going to talk about something that may have fallen under your radar with all the other things that are happening right now. The State Department has set up a commission on inalienable rights that has human rights advocates worried, LGBTQ advocates worried, and reproductive rights advocates worried. So today, in the interview that you're going to hear, I am lucky enough to talk to two amazing human rights advocates who are going to talk to me about what is happening. First, we have Amanda Classing with the Human Rights Watch, and next we have Tara DeMant with Amnesty International to talk with us about why we should be worried about this new commission. Hi, Tara and Amanda. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So why don't you two take a minute and introduce yourself so that people can get used to who's talking when. Amanda, do you want to go first?
I sure do. Thanks so much. This is Amanda Classing. I am the acting co-director of the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch.
And this is Tara DeMant, and I'm the director of the Gender, Sexuality, and Identity Program at Amnesty International USA.
Wonderful. Thank you, ladies, for being here. I'm excited to talk about a horrible thing.
You'll have to get more specific these days.
It's kind of my brand now, I guess, is talking about horrible things, so... Yay. So I guess before we get into the commission, let's start at the beginning with what are human rights?
That is a big question.
We could do multiple episodes just on that.
Exactly. But the important thing for people to understand is that human rights are part of an international legal framework. And a lot of times people in the United States think of human rights as civil and political rights. So the right to not be tortured, the right of freedom of assembly. But human rights are much more broad than that. Starting back with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there was a broad acceptance that there are rights to health, or right to education, and in addition to the civil and political rights we're used to. And so all of these rights are interrelated, they're interdependent, and they're also equal under this legal framework.
I mean, I think, ironically, right, human rights are also inalienable, which is that they can't be taken away from you. You have human rights because you are human, and legal documents and agreements that have recognized those things have recognized that you can't just pick and choose, and you can't cherry pick human rights. And so kind of the great irony about what we're dealing with right now with this so-called Inalienable Rights Commission and a quote-unquote return to inalienable rights is that human rights are inalienable. They can't be taken away from you. And that includes rights that the Trump administration doesn't like and doesn't want to give to people and wants to actually take away. And so that's a really critical thing. Like, in its words, human rights defenders, human rights advocates, like, agree that human rights are inalienable. But, of course, like, the Orwellian work that's happening right now is taking terms and switching their meaning around, which is, of course, exactly what the State Department is saying that human rights defenders and human rights advocates are doing, and lecturing human rights organizations around what rights are and aren't. Like, human rights are things you have because you were born with rights, no matter who you are, and they can't be taken away from you. And they can't be redefined by an administration or a political party because they're inconvenient or they conflict with a certain belief of who deserves rights. All people deserve rights, and they all deserve all of their rights.
We definitely already saw some of this happening with the State Department arguing that, you know, reproductive rights, there's no, like, agreed upon term as to what that is, and people are saying that's what that is, and that's not true. As you said, there's legal frameworks at the UN that have defined things like that. But beyond reproductive rights, maybe we'll just go to human rights and some of the UN frameworks that have been set up.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the important things that you are alluding to is that the United States is not the owner of human rights. Mm. That human rights, not only being inalienable, are this framework was a framework that came together after all UN member states adopted a Universal Declaration of Human Rights saying this is what human rights are. And then that was followed up with binding treaties that different countries have signed and ratified. Within those binding treaties, everything from the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights and the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, there are additional treaties that include CEDAW, which a lot of the audience might be familiar with. That's the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. There's also the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, among others. Now, these conventions...
It's also interesting you picked three the U.S. has not signed.
Yeah. Signed but not ratified.
Oh, sorry. You're right.
Right. No, but that's an important distinction that ratification requires Senate approval, and it's something that we just haven't seen happen in the United States around these rights of women, for example, and of children, which is shameful after decades of waiting.
Yeah. And these conventions and rights, for example, the Convention Against Torture, they're not expansions of rights. And the more that we talk about rights, it's not just expansions or redefinitions, it's explanations. So, for example, the right to life, which is part of the UDHR, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, what the Convention of Torture says is like, oh, actually, torture is a violation of your right to life. So part of this administration's claim has been, well, we're getting back to basics as opposed to these, what they're considering expansions or redefinitions. And it's all the things that have been agreed upon, again, by countries over the last 65 years. It's not that we're redefining human rights, but that we're clarifying what they actually mean. Like, what does the right to life mean? And the right to life means that you can't be tortured. It also means the right to not be tortured means you can't be forced to carry a pregnancy, right? What does the right to freedom of expression mean? And those things have been clarified through agreements. So this idea that somehow this administration of all administrations, but certainly the United States as a country in and of itself, can somehow get us, quote unquote, back to basics, which is a phrase that's been used, is frankly a lie. Like, it is not honest, and it's not intending to do that at all. It's intending to really narrow down what certain rights, who gets certain rights, I mean, who doesn't, right? Because all these treaties and conventions that have come out are basic human rights. The right to choose the number and space in your children, the right to accurate sex and sex education information. Those things are basic human rights, and they've been clarified by agreement and by years and years of working together based off basic human rights, the right to education, for example, the right to bodily autonomy. Well, what do we mean by those things? And that's where conventions and agreed upon documents come in, right? It's not some sort of hocus pocus. Like, this is years and decades of clarifying together as a global community. And this administration, but any administration in this country, doesn't get to just swoop in and decide what human rights are and aren't. Because what we're seeing is that idea used for very specific political ends, which is to cut rights for certain people.
And maybe if we can take a step back and relate, like, how is it that these rights have been clarified and defined over time? So I'm going to use one example, but I think, and I'll come back to the right to life as well, but the right to live free of domestic violence, which is, I think, a right that we all inherently feel, women in particularly inherently feel, is a component of our fundamental human rights, wasn't originally written into treaty. And that was a significant oversight. And what it meant was that reporting over years, grassroots organizations, defenders on the ground put forward evidence to different human rights bodies, including the committee that actually oversees the implementation of the CEDAW, but also in the International Criminal Court or criminal law component of the broader regime of human rights. Over time, we started to understand why gender-based violence is a human rights issue and the right to live free of violence is a human rights issue. And this happened, we can all agree that that's a fundamental human right. It just wasn't properly defined in the treaties that were negotiated, mainly by men, let's be honest. And so the rights are not living or changing, but these documents do, and that's really important. The right to life is another really great example, because the committee that oversees the implementation of that covenant is called the Human Rights Committee. And they all of these committees get to issue what's called general comments or general recommendations. They're essentially like advisory opinions interpreting clauses that exist within their treaties. And the right to life is a fundamental part of that. And early on in the committee, they issued a general comment on what the right to life meant. And recently, they've reissued a general comment that really demonstrates that states have an obligation to make sure that women don't die in childbirth. Mm-hmm. They also have issued recommendations that people don't die from gun violence when guns are unregulated, really looking and digging into how people experience their rights and making recommendations to states to respond to it. All of that said, the U.S. does not get to pick from a menu and say, this is mm-hmm. what we'll agree with and this is what we won't. Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that we should also flesh out is something you mentioned earlier, and that's the distinction between economic, social, cultural rights, and civil and political rights.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so this, I mean, this is like the heart of the geopolitical kind of history of human rights. The Universal Declaration saw these rights as unified. And
countries agreed, ultimately, that these are unified.
Exactly. And I mean, think about Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, there was talk in this country in the 30s and 40s of having a second Bill of Rights that encompassed economic, social, and cultural rights. And that mm-hmm. sort of spirit that Eleanor Roosevelt brought to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is really reflected in how these rights are presented as a holistic approach to human rights. And yet, in the interim between this declaration, which is non-binding, and the treaties, which are binding, the Cold War took effect. And so when treaties were being negotiated, all of a sudden there was this rift where the U.S. was promoting the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the Soviet bloc was promoting the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Covenant. These are false dichotomies. All of these, and a lot of times people talk about some as negative rights and others positives. One is the government should stop doing something, and the other is the government should do something. Mm-hmm. That's not at all the case. We can see that discrimination actively prevents women and girls from accessing education, healthcare. And so that's very much so part of economic and social and cultural rights. Another false dichotomy is that civil and political rights don't take money, but economic, social, and cultural rights take a lot of money. And so you're really talking about budgets when you're talking about fulfillment of these rights. Well, if anybody has looked at the amount of money that's invested in rule of law programs and reinvestment in justice systems, or what it takes to have a free and fair election in a country, we all know that these are huge investments of money, equal or surpassing that of investments in healthcare. So the straw men that have been proposed over the United States for years about why these rights, economic, social, and cultural rights, aren't really right, just don't hold up in practice.
Well, and the bottom line is, like, these straw men have been put forward ultimately because the United States has always wanted to pick and choose by which rights, by which account it holds itself and which rights it prioritizes, and then also how it calls out which rights are more important so it can call out human rights abusers for political gain, right, as opposed to actually upholding human rights. I mean, I think the other false dichotomy is this idea that you can have civil and political rights without economic, cultural, and social rights, which you can't. Like, the right to participate in your government meaningfully, which here in the United States is voting, like, you can't have that right if you don't have an economic, cultural, social right to education fulfilled. That right is meaningless, right? If a woman or a pregnant person doesn't have the right to control the number and spacing of their children, the right to participate in government is meaningless if you can't actually control your own body, right? So economic, cultural, social rights, they are necessary for political and civil rights. So even if the United States or whomever is in power in the government truly believes that a certain number of rights are more important than economic, cultural, and social rights, you need economic, cultural, and social rights to make civil and political rights real. The reality is that you need them more for marginalized communities. And so, you know, all people need economic, social, cultural rights, men, boys, you know, dominant racial communities. Everyone needs economic, cultural, social rights. But when those rights are taken away or when those rights are marginalized, it is much more likely that women, people of color, poorer communities, LGBTQI people, those are the people who are less likely to be able to access their civil and political rights. So it has served a very specific identity-based political agenda to really de-emphasize economic, cultural, social rights, the same way it fit a very, very specific geopolitical agenda to argue against a certain number of rights that other countries whom the United States was in conflict with were upholding, right? So it's really convenient to be like, oh, those aren't important rights because we're really bad at them, and also because the people we're mad at are better at some of them than we are, right? So this, again, this idea that somehow, even if you thought civil and political rights were more important, which, and as Amanda said, they're so intersectional and they're so intertwined. Even if you did think that, it is absolutely wrongheaded and evidence-based, clearly untrue, that you can have civil and political rights without full implementation and guarantee of economic, cultural, and social rights.
And taking a step back, you know, we're thinking about this as a foreign policy issue, but ultimately what human rights are is an obligation that a government has to the people living inside its borders. There's also extraterritorial obligations. We don't talk about that. But really, it's a commitment, a global commitment to how a government will treat the people within its borders. And so even though this particular commission or the way the U.S. actually plays in the human rights space is very much so about foreign policy. It's to keep the eye off of the ball. And the ball is not just this administration, but certainly being really reflected in this administration. The U.S. has consistently said at the international level that it does not believe in the right to health. It does not believe to the right to water, does not believe to in the right to education. And that is reflected in domestic policy over and again when you actually look at people's human rights within the United States. And this is only reinforcing that and really delegitimizing those grassroots attempts to really start in the United States to claim human rights that look different from civil and political rights.
Mm-hmm. So that brings us to the Commission on Inalienable Rights. So, what is it?
Well, let's start with a little context,
yeah,
which is what it's not, which is somehow abhorrent to this administration, right? I think it's really important that people see this commission and the announcement of this Commission on Inalienable Rights, which was an announcement by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, that a commission is going to be set forth that will re-examine human rights and a sort of get back to basics approach based on a number of very specific documents, right, including the UDHR. I think the Rights of Man was, Thomas Paine's Rights of Man was introduced in this list of documents they'd reassess global human rights with. And so there's this commission at the State Department. But what it's not is this sort of like standalone threat to human rights out of this administration, and frankly, beyond this administration, which is, you know, we think a lot about Trump the person, we think then also about Trump the administration, but like none of this is possible without a total failure on Congress's part, and particularly in the Republican Party trying to continually redefine human rights for political gain, right? And that's not, it's not wholly specific to one party, but what we're seeing now is more and more the Republican Party fall in line with a very specific understanding of like what is convenient to describe as human rights because of a deeply held political or religious or personal belief as to who gets to qualify as fully human. So this, I want to put that context out there because it is a really scary individual thing, but it is part of a long line of attacks in which this administration particularly, and which Congress has allowed to happen, is chipping away at fundamental definitions, right? This isn't like friends can disagree or intelligent people can disagree about a specific what is the interpretation of this or that, but like a real dismantling of a human rights framework and the United States participation in human rights in general, even the Human Rights Council or with the UN. But as to like what it specifically is, it's a commission. And so in some ways, it doesn't seem that scary or important because it's a number of people sort of sitting around in a room making pronouncements, right? But we have already seen what that means, which again, in congressional speak is Congress people trying to get into specific laws or appropriations bills, language like natural rights instead of human rights. Human rights, which again are very well and clearly defined. When the State Department says they're not, it's a bold-faced lie. Like human rights are very well and clearly defined, and I'm happy to resend the documents to the State Department if they'd like to see them again. They have them. The United States has signed them, right? Human rights are very well defined. Natural rights are not particularly well defined in international human rights law, and they tend to refer back to one religion's very specific understanding of what types of things people need or deserve.
And just to be very clear, within the State Department, there already is a structure of a bureau that is focused on rights, that is a mandate to report on human rights. And there are other structures that engage in international organizations that are focused on human rights. So what this also is not just a commission, but a parallel structure outside of the normal structure that has been set up in order to look at human rights issues within the State Department, a parallel structure that is, you know, frankly, doesn't have the same oversight and is quite worrying because the mandate is all the things that Tara has said and is unnecessary. And so it's, if you're a fiscal conservative, it's really wasteful. On top of everything else, it's also really, really wasteful. The other thing to note is when we think about going back to these getting back to the basics for rights, it's often talking about those rights that have already been enjoyed by a certain part of the population.
Right.
These are rights that have been enjoyed and may be threatened by people that look like the people in power. These are, you know, is a dissident able to publish a book? And totally important, but still is a small percentage of the human rights violations we see. You know, is there an active opposition movement in government in a particular country, which is usually elite, you know, that are engaging? All of these things are important, but from a gender perspective, is very often the rights that have not yet been enjoyed by the vast majority of the population, including women and girls and people of trans experience. And so I just, it's really important for us to understand when we say going back to basics, we're going back to a certain set of rights that already were so far from being realized and enjoyed by the vast majority of the population around the world.
Yeah, the Secretary of State has announced this as a fresh new, was it fresh new perspective, fresh new thinking? And I think, you know, anybody listening to this podcast will find it ludicrous that this administration should be leading any discussion on human rights when it so flagrantly, boldly, and explicitly is violating human rights, and like unapologetically, right, violating human rights as like a fundamental point of the administration's policy, not whether it's out of the State Department and foreign policy, whether it's on our own borders, whether it's within our own borders, right? So just that alone is laughable. But ultimately also, again, back to what Amanda said earlier, like the United States doesn't get to decide in a bubble what human rights are. Like human rights are global, and globally we have sat down and discussed these things. And this, you know, again, what inalienable means is they can't be taken away, which means that you can't actually sit down and redefine rights and say like, oh, we only like these other rights, which in the 50s really were only enjoyed by certain people and certain identities, right? What we don't like is the discussion of LGBTQI people enjoying rights that the United States doesn't want to give them. What we don't like is the idea that women and other people can control their reproduction, because I don't personally believe that that should be a thing. Well, that's great, but international human rights law is very clear on that. And so this is a tool, like many others in the tool belt of this administration, trying to dismantle just basic concepts of human rights because they don't like them, because they don't agree with them, and because they don't like them because they benefit certain groups of people, right? All rights for all people is not something this administration is interested in. So wants to roll back human rights and re-carve out a very specific type of definition of the rights that really benefit a very specific group of people. And shockingly, that group doesn't involve women, you know, people who can reproduce. It doesn't involve LGBTQI people. And like, that's specifically what we're seeing. This administration is also very clearly not interested in the rights of asylum seekers, migrants, or refugees. It's also very clearly not interested in the rights of people of color. There's a number of groups that are being attacked on multiple fronts. And like, so this idea that, one, this administration's in any place to lecture anybody, especially outside the U.S. borders, on human rights is laughable. But also, it's not even veiled at this point. This is just clearly an attempt to redefine the State Department's work and the U.S.'s work in general within its own borders to not benefit certain groups of people, redefining rights so it really only benefits the people you think need rights. Every person has the right to their own religious belief, whether or not they think abortion is good or bad, whether or not they think that like LGBTQI people are like good or bad, whether or not they think that certain races have different quality. You get to believe whatever you want. You have that right. What you don't have is the right to impose this religious belief on other people. And that's what's happening. I mean, in one sense, you can see this as the idea that one can impose their fringe religion on other people, right? And of course, the irony is like this is what this administration rails against, this idea of somehow like fringe religion being imposed on the United States in terms of like the war, the so-called war on terror. But that's exactly what's happening here, which is a specific religious view of who gets rights and what rights are actually good and bad being imposed across governmental agencies and therefore like on the lives of everyday people, whether they're outside our borders or inside our borders or at our border.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I think what's really important to keep in mind in that context is the right to exercise your religion is a fundamental human right, and yet we have very clear indication within human rights law that you can't pit rights against each other. Mm-hmm. So where my right to exercise my freedom of religion or my right to exercise my freedom of expression starts to impend and impose on your right to realize other human rights, we have a tension that needs to be resolved by the state. And so that's just not a balancing act that is actually happening right now.
Yeah, it really feels like they're picking one predominant worldview and trying to impose it on everybody else, and that's not how human rights work.
And what I really worry about, beyond the fact that we're thinking about a redefinition of human rights and that being imposed, is what it means for human rights defenders on the ground. Mm-hmm. Because globally, this closing space of civil society is impacting human rights defenders and human rights defenders that are already marginalized in their own communities, including women's human rights defenders, LGBT defenders, indigenous peoples, people of ethnic minorities or religious minorities. These are people that are on the front lines of protecting rights of their communities or themselves. When you say that the rights that they are defending are in fact not human rights, then what are they? Mm-hmm. What are those people? They are more vulnerable. It's difficult for their cases to be championed by human rights defenders. I mean, oftentimes, you know, for good or for bad, the U.S. government has played a complicated role in human rights. But oftentimes when you see a rights defender at risk, there is an important role for a U.S. embassy to play or the mm-hmm. State Department to play in making sure that that person's life is not taken or that their indefinite detention is curtailed. If all of a sudden the rights that these people are fighting for are no longer recognized by the State Department, that is one less protection for people that are already really, really vulnerable to repression, to violence, and to ultimately being silenced.
Well, and that just makes me think of how interconnected, again, everything is. And if you're defining away human rights, that means people can't use that ground anymore. If the State Department has decided that reproductive rights or freedom from gender-based violence or whatever are no longer human rights, then people don't have that ground anymore to come to the U.S. for asylum to escape, you know, violence or oppression. And again, everything is connected.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we see that the Department of Justice had a decision late last year that actually made domestic violence no longer a grounds for seeking asylum. And so you see this interconnectedness across the board. And also when you're not, and this is separate from the commission, but what is being reported on within the human rights reports that the State Department issues annually has been limited when it comes to women's rights, both on the grounds of violence, but also on women's reproductive rights, where the entire section of reproductive rights has been excised. And so these grounds in which people seek asylum are becoming difficult. And how these reports are being used are typically judges look at these reports. Are you saying that the grounds for persecution that you are facing are in fact true? And they look at Amnesty's reports, they look at Human Rights Watch's reports, but honestly, the State Department reports become so much more important as a state of record of government document. And that's whole parts of these reports that relate to women's rights are just silent now.
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, like part of this broad train of regression. And the impact that we're looking at is huge. It's not just a commission that spouts off a bunch of absolutely unintelligible malarkey that's like handpicked about what rights we get. Although it is really important to understand that the people appointed to this commission are like the who's who's of anti-women, anti-LGBTI rights. Like, it's a very specific group of people who have worked to redefine human rights to be exclusionary, right? So we're talking about real people's lives who are claiming asylum. We're talking about real people's lives who've depended on the U.S. government in a number of instances to protect or champion certain rights in their own country that they're at risk. But we're also talking about the United United States broadly just redefining what rights it will work for outside its borders and work with countries, or what rights inside its borders. I mean, this is something that we see this at Human Rights Watch, at Amnesty. We see this all the time. We see it in the Philippines, where the rights, you know, are being the right to not be summarily executed is rolled back because the administration there is redefining who gets rights and who doesn't get rights. And in this case, if you're suspected of drug dealing or drug involvement, right, you don't have rights anymore. We see this with oppressive regimes where, like, you don't have the right to access internet, or you don't have the right to this, you don't have the right to that. Like, these are the exact same things. So however people want to call this administration, whatever words we want to use, like, we see this. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch have documented this type of behavior for decades. Who gets to be defined as fully human? Who gets to have rights? And whose rights are actually inalienable, right? Whose rights can't be taken away? We've documented this. Human Rights Watch has documented this for decades. And that's what's happening here, is an administration in power using its power to roll back access of human rights to very specific groups of people.
So we've already started to touch on this. What could be the impacts that we're going to see from this commission, or the decisions that come out of it?
Yeah, it's a little hard to tell what, like, decisions, but I mean, certainly the types of redefinitions that we're going to get. If you look at the people who've been appointed, these are people who've argued throughout their careers that the right to marriage does not extend to LGBTI people, that the right to choose the number and space in your children doesn't include the right to abortion, that the right to life doesn't include the right not to be tortured, or doesn't include the right not to be forced to carry a pregnancy, for example, you know, things like this. So you can see the type of direction it's going. And the mm-hmm. question is, like, well, what does that actually mean? Like, where is this going to go? Or is there just going to be a couple of thought pieces, right? Well, one thing we've already seen in Congress since the announcement of this is certain senators and representatives trying to get this language into law, which is, instead of using human rights language, again, which is very well defined and has very specific obligations, using the language natural law, which is some sort of religious allusion, right, to a very specific group of laws that I don't know who gets to define, whoever's church is in power at the time, right? So we've seen this already, even in, what's it been, two? Has it been a week, 2 weeks? Time has no meaning. That, like, we've seen this already, that in the last week and a half, that we've seen try to slip in this, like, aha, this is the language we're going to use now, right? So we've already seen this impact, even though the commission hasn't even gotten started. They haven't, you know, they haven't actually met yet, to our knowledge, or if they have, they haven't put out any announcements on it. But what we're also likely to see then is this commission redefining the obligations and understandings of the State Department, and of course that trickling down to other departments in the administration that become then U.S.-focused, Health and Human Services or Interior, you know, whatever that is, which is to say, how does the U.S. interact with the world? What is it we define as the things that drive our agenda and that are going to impact what we can and can't do? For example, if you've decided that the right to torture is not an inalienable, or the right to not be tortured is not an inalienable right, then when you're involved with another country, or when you're involved in an offsite, you know, an off U.S. black site, you're not actually violating human rights because you've redefined what human rights are. Now, you are very much violating human rights because you don't get to decide what human rights are. Those are decided together, right? But that's the type of thing that we're likely to see, which is the U.S. redefining how it engages in the world, what it's allowed to do, and also what it allows countries it works with to do. Who are the people we're holding accountable? And, you know, as Amanda said so well, for good or for ill, the U.S. has had a very complicated but very important role in human rights globally, often very uneven role in human rights globally. But what it has been able to do is, with certain countries, exert influence over certain countries that are violating human rights to say, like, we're not going to work with you in this, and we're going to pressure you against this because of your record on human rights in this way, right? And again, that's been uneven, and there's been a lot of ups and downs. But, like, where that has happened, there has been impact because the U.S. has been committed to human rights. Redefining human rights, or taking out what certain rights you're going to fight for, is not just a U.S. problem. It then becomes a global problem because of the influence of the United States globally. And that, it's terrifying, not only for the way that we interact with the world and, of course, with our own people within our borders and at our borders, but also then the way that it motivates other rights-violating governments to be much bolder about that. And not only to just be bolder about the rights violations that are already going on, and Philippines, I think, is a great example of that being bolstered by this administration, then, but also then stepping up other rights violations because there is no consequence from the United States. And with the United States being such a forceful global player, again, for good or for ill, where the United States goes with that, others will follow. And indeed, others have already followed, right? Redefining human rights and then being totally, absolutely justified by the United States in doing that. So there's no then consequence for them because that relationship is kind of what they're looking to. So the potential for this is vast. And I think it's, there's so many things that are so, there's just so many things that are so consequential happening that I think it's easy for folks to be like, oh, this is just hysterical. We are talking about a total redefinition of human rights led by the Trump administration.
That's scary, just on its face.
That's scary. Yeah. And that's not hysterical to think about the way we've seen some of the things that have tried to do in the shadows, right? At UN gatherings, at UN meetings, at multilateral spaces, or even just within the United States itself, which doesn't involve, you know, maybe within internal agencies like Health and Human Services, trying to erase trans people out of existence by just changing some words, with USAID trying to erase LGBTQ people by erasing the word gender. Like, we've seen this happen in multiple spaces in the interior, in our own country borders, and the way that's then influenced at our U.S. border very visibly. And now we're looking at the way that this administration is trying to export that hate and export that exclusion. And that it should not be underestimated how much impact that can have. Also, the idea that whomever comes into power next, or whatever every 4 to 8 years, you know, comes into power, that you can just rewrite the U.S.'s commitments to treaties, to, you know, human rights as a word and concept, right? That in and of itself is also terrifying.
Yeah, and I would say that the chilling effect that this has on how other governments engage with the U.S. government, particularly in U.N. spaces, is really important. And I think the U.N. Security Council resolution on women, peace, and security maybe a month ago is a great example where, you know, it should be uncontroversial to talk about the rights of women and all people. What was great about that resolution is expanded the definition of victims of sexual violence and conflict, but how people who are victims of sexual violence and conflict need to access types of services. And the U.S. government actually threatened a veto at the Security Council to remove mention of sexual and reproductive health and rights. And that's going to change the fight that came out of that. It's going to change the way that other governments approach resolutions, approach engagement in the UN space, even those that are champions of a broad definition of human rights. I think that's also the case when you start to look at the different human rights mechanisms, including the regional and the UN mechanisms, the way they really dig and grapple with what these rights mean. Treaty bodies do this, but also the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And a few months ago, the State Department actually found that the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights was in violation of a U.S. law called the Silgender Amendment because it had issued a press release that actually was stating where international law currently is on access to abortion, which is that abortion and that states should decriminalize abortion in at a minimum in the cases of the health or life of a woman, case of fetal malformation or unviable pregnancy, unviable fetus, and in the case of sexual violence. And the interpretation of the statement of law by the State Department was that that was actually advocacy for abortion. And so rather than seeing this as a human rights analysis, because these are human rights mechanisms that are actually, you know, interpreting what exists in international law, it was seen as advocacy for a certain position. And you can see like the slight echoes of what then that would look like as these treaty mechanisms actually start to grapple with broader issues. I mean, we were just talking about the rights to water and sanitation, and that there was this pushback on the idea that sanitation is a human right. Well, are they going to intervene when there are mechanisms that are, you know, calling for the right to sanitation to be implemented? Are they going to start to engage with the UN General Assembly if there's a resolution on the table that is recognizing what the right to adequate standard of living means and really try to influence the outcomes there? We just have no idea what the impact will be, but it's going to certainly have a ripple effect across the globe.
Yeah. And, you know, when you say, when the Secretary of State says that human rights have gone too far, and also that special interest groups, by which he means human rights groups, right? Like, to be really clear, when human rights have gone too far, according to the Secretary of State, it's because people that don't look like him get to access human rights, right? When special interest groups are trying to have an influence, it's special interest groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and people who are standing up for human rights that he doesn't like and the administration doesn't like because they don't fit with a very specific definition of who gets rights, right? So that ripple effect, like everyone will be impacted by this, but much more people, marginalized peoples will be impacted like this by this. So the sanitation example, I think, is so important because the right to sanitation, the United States government pushing back against that, it's because the right to sanitation specifically and explicitly disproportionately impacts people of color and low-income people in the United States. And so if the United States said out loud, you're right, the right to sanitation, which is very clearly defined in international human rights laws and obligations to which we are a party, applies, this is a real thing, we as a country would have to grapple with the fact that, like, Flint, Michigan, dominantly black, does not have water. We would have to grapple with the fact that, like, indigenous peoples live in, you know, food deserts, as do many people in urban spaces, and that those people are disproportionately from marginalized communities, right? So again, this is not rocket science as to why Mike Pompeo is suddenly interested in human rights discourse, right? The sort of theoretics of human rights. It's to very specifically stop the U.S. from participating in promoting or not attacking specific human rights for specific people. It's a lot, right?
It's a lot.
It's a lot, and it's a part of this broad panoply of attacks that have happened out of this administration. And this one can seem so nerdy and so, like, technical and, like, why does it matter, you know, and that's, I think that fatigue is real. Like, yeah. There are really important things, and the things that are happening to people on our border, the things that are happening by the U.S. government, the things that are happening abroad by the U.S. government, the rights that are being rolled back in law in the states, like, these are all really terrifying and can seem much more tangible. But the implications of this are every right for every person. Every right for every person is at stake when the U.S. says it's going to redefine human rights. Every right for every person is at stake when the U.S. State Department gets up and has a commission that's going to be the think tank of human rights. Like, no rights will matter in the United States if the Trump administration redefines human rights. And because of our position in the world as a country, that will have huge implications globally, not just the work that we do, but the work that other countries are willing to do or actively violate rights because now they just don't get to be called rights, right? So it's really important that, like, there's a lot of fatigue. It is very technical. It is a commission, which what does that even mean? But, like, the implications are really huge and they cover every right for every person.
And this is coming at a time when I feel like I've really seen, and I'm sure you have as well, Tara, in your work, that there is a embracing in the United States among grassroots groups of human rights. For years, that there really was kind of a disconnect where human rights were something that happened over there, and in the United States, we have these rights. But I don't think it's a coincidence that this is happening at a time where you start to see people really claiming and rising up and saying, yes, I do have this human right to health, and I do have this human right to water, and I do have this human right to education. Often, when things that happen in the State Department don't really register for people that are working very hard in their own communities in the United States to move the ball forward. But this is a local to global problem, mm-hmm. and we can't let it just happen on the side and let the technicality of it or the location and jurisdiction of it mm-hmm. distract us from the fact that this is about dividing people and taking away the progress, the movement towards all rights for all people.
Well, and it's also, the U.S. likes to test bad things in their foreign policy and then bring them home.
Absolutely. We've seen that in things like the so-called global gag rule or Mexico City, which is abortion bans, which were then brought back home through how can we pay for abortion care in the United States. And of course, like, if you're poor and need abortion care and you're dependent on U.S. federal money, like, you don't get to have that, right? And that's an exported, we tried it out abroad, we brought it back here, and it's that repression of rights there as an example.
So I always like to end with a positive or at least an action step people can take after such a heavy episode. So what can listeners do to push back or fight back against everything that's happening in around human rights right now?
Yeah. So the good news is that we have three branches of government and that actually whoever happens to be in power in the administration does not get to unilaterally make decisions like this. They do if they go unchecked. Right. And so what the most important thing is that actually this type of decision gets checked, and that happens by Congress. So people should be reaching out to their elected representatives and asking for Congress to first defund this commission. Congress pays. They decide where our tax money goes. Right. Your tax money goes to this abomination. Right. And so this is something that Congress has direct control over. So calling your representative, your senator, and asking for this to be defunded. Right. That is a specific role that Congress has. The second is to hold a hearing. Congress has oversight, which is once they've paid for something, they then get to say, hey, we paid for this. What's happening? What's going on? So both the Senate and the House can hold hearings and demand explanations and definitions, right? What do you mean by natural law? How is this not redundant to the Democracy, Rights, and Labor Bureau? I mean, plot spoiler, it is. Like, why is this happening? What are your intentions? What is the role of this? Answering the questions that, frankly, that you've been asking that we don't have firm answers to. What do you expect the outcome to be of this? Why have this? What are you trying to change, right? Congress has a very specific role. So people should be calling their elected officials and demanding that they take action on this. And there's so much happening that there, you know, this is very easy to fall through the cracks, but Congress has a very specific and very powerful role it could play.
And I want to think about this as an opportunity because the U.S. prior to this commission, prior to this administration, has been agnostic at best, hostile at worst to the idea of economic, social, and cultural rights. And it has, in many ways, picked and chosen between the rights that it's going to uphold. And so if this is an opportunity for everyone to realize what is at stake when we talk about human rights, to realize that there are human rights that encompass everything that I think probably your listeners hold dear, including the right to health, then this is an opportunity to raise that with your lawmakers, not mm-hmm. only to stop this commission, but really to fight for a progressive idea of human rights that the rest of the world has caught on to and we haven't. And so my pie in the sky mm-hmm. is fight for the Senate to ratify the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Yeah. Fight for it to ratify CEDAW. Fight for it to ratify CRC. And that might not happen this year. And it might not happen in 2 years. But that is one way for it mm-hmm. to prevent administrations to go back and forth and saying, mm-hmm. what are human rights? They're there. They're in a treaty. It's teed up. There's a mechanism to actually ratify these. Yeah. Let's do it. And, you know, this is the generation that can make it happen at some point in time. So I just let's take the opportunity. Let's not all be, discouraged by what right now is very discouraging.
Yeah.
Well, Tara, Amanda, thank you so much for being here. I had a great time talking about such horrible things.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
For more information, including show notes from this episode and previous episodes, please visit our website at reprosfightback.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at reprosfightback. If you like our show, please help others find it by sharing it with your friends and subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.